This is David Blair, recorded at his home near Paignton in Devon by Chris Eldon Lee on the 12th of February 2006. David Blair Part 1, in which we look through his personal archives.
I understand that you did an interview with Bob Bond, who was the chap I took over from when I went down there. And I dug this out the other day when I was looking through my archives, and it was a letter which Bob left for me at Deception Island when they flew south to our operating base at Adelaide Island. Perhaps you'd like to have a read of that.
So is it the 11th of November 1962? What are the key points he makes? Do you remember, David?
Really, it's telling about some spares that he wanted us to take down. We had spares in the hangar at Deception Island, various things that he wanted.
So it's a factual, practical letter rather than a love
it
letter
is.
Or a...
No love letter about it. I hadn't met Bob at that time, and in fact, I didn't meet him until we eventually sailed into Adelaide Island, and he checked me out on the skis with the otter.
What else do we have in front of us then? What are your price?
Well, I've got my logbook here, but let's have a look first. Maybe you'd like to have a look through the this album. It won't come out on your recording, but if you'd like to have a quick look through that.
What am I looking for?
I noticed on Joanna's list here, she asked about what training we'd done before we went down to the Antarctic. Well, we went out to this other chap, Bill Stutt, who was my colleague out there. He and I went out to Canada to the de Havilland factory at Downsview, and we spent a week going over the aircraft through the factory. Then we went down to a Canadian Air Force base in further down to the east of Toronto, and it was Trenton actually, and we flew the Otter, or were given a conversion onto the Otter, and we did quite a bit of flying there. I did about 15 hours, and during that time, one of the things that the Canadian Air Force chaps were rather keen on was that we should get some experience in what they called whiteout flying. Now, we were out there in the summertime, and we couldn't do this because there was no snow, naturally. So what they did was they took us out in an otter equipped with floats, and we flew this off Lake Ontario, and it was on a day when there was virtually no wind, and it was a glassy surface, and which was very similar to flying in a whiteout.
The reflection of the sun on the water.
Yeah, and virtually no conception of judging height. So what we did was we approached the surface until we got down to about maybe a couple hundred feet. Then we reduced our rate of descent to about 150 feet a minute, and we just held that rate of descent until the floats touched the surface and throttled back, and that was it. And this was a similar technique to what we used down in the Antarctic, flying on skis. Whiteout, I don't know if Bob explained this to you.
Please do.
But in whiteout, this occurs when you've got usually 8/8 coverage of cloud and virtually no shadows appearing on the surface. So if you're flying in a vast expanse of snow, then you get no definition of height. Mm. So this is the technique that we used, and we did it down there, flying in whiteout conditions, and it worked perfectly.
So you just transferred the technique from this Lake Ontario to the Antarctic ice sheets, and you were
Skis. Similar technique.
Not quite, a bit bumpier though in the ice, presumably.
It depended. If there was a lot of sastrugi around, then it could get a little bit lumpy.
How did you feel about this at the time? Do you remember? Because this presumably was a rather new experience for you, was it all?
Well, I did my training in Canada during the war, and I had some experience of flying in snow conditions. In fact, the last landing I had before I got my wings when I was training was a belly landing in a harbour where the undercarriage got frozen up and we couldn't lock it down and it had to land on the belly.
Right.
apart from that, I'd done ferrying sabres across the Atlantic through Greenland and Iceland and... I knew a fair bit about the Arctic conditions.
Is this an otter here on Lake Ontario?
This is an otter here.
Was that your first experience of otters?
We did our conversion on wheels, first of all. In fact, looking at my logbook here...
this is August 1962.
We went out to, it was 24th of August we went out there, first started flying.
But you hadn't really had any otter experience before that?
No, none.
Had you flown single prop before?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
You had? Yes. Was there something new to get used to?
I'd been flying jets. If you look at my logbook before, in that month I flew... Vampires, Jet Provosts, and Chipmunks.
Right. But generally speaking, you talked to the otter quite readily.
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
Did you?
Nice aircraft.
What was good about it?
Yeah. Good, solid aeroplane. Very reliable engine. Pratt & Whitney Wasp, 600 horsepower. I made a few notes here if you are interested in...
you want to take me through them?
Yeah. I'll give you a quick description. The aircraft is a high-wing monoplane, fuselage, pilot compartment up front, and a cabin at the rear with a door which opened and allowed access to items such as dog sledges and things to get in. The engine was a 600 horsepower Pratt & Whitney Wasp. Normal fuel load endurance was 6.5 hours. We carried survival gear on board the aircraft to the weight of 350 pounds. That included a small sledge with food, etc. Two pairs of skis and a sea survival dinghy, which we needed for flying across Marguerite Bay. Mm. You've been to Marguerite Bay.
Yes.
Normal payload with full internal fuel was, I think it's a long time ago now. I can't quite read my writing. It's
1,200?
No, it's... Yes, 1,200 pounds.
Hmm. Did you feel that the safety precautions were everything you'd want?
At that time, I expect we did. I mean, we had... difficult to say now, sort of in retrospect, but what could one expect down there at that period? We had two-way communications with the bases, and that was about it, really.
Well, I think Bob was saying, from memory, was saying that they had an inflatable dinghy in case of splashdown, which was replaced every year. Mm. And when the new one arrived, they tried out the old one, and it never worked.
Yeah.
Is that your experience?
I never knew that. Probably just as well. Yeah.
What else have you noted down, Dave?
The operational task, Joanna was interested in knowing about that. And our task was establishment of field parties, air support for the field parties, supplying the southern base. You never got down as far south as Fossil Bluff.
I didn't know, but you were you were there the year after Bob Bond, weren't you, I think?
Yeah.
So you were picking up the work that he'd done to establish the base.
Yeah. Well, Bob will have told you all about the establishment of the base, I suppose, haven't you? Well, the other thing we did was reconnaissance of project areas.
How do you mean?
Well, where field parties like the geologists and surveyors were going, we would do a reconnaissance of the place first, picking out possible landing sites for dropping them off and picking them up when they'd completed their tasks. We also did depot laying. That was laying down man and dog food, because at that time we had huskies. Mm. And we also collected, we laid down man food, dog food and fuel for the field parties. That was mainly geologists and surveyors.
So were you constantly finding yourself flying to places you hadn't been to before?
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And was this all naked eye navigation?
Oh, yeah, virtually, yes. Mm. Yeah, we had ADF on board the aircraft.
ADF is?
Automatic direction finding, which we didn't use much, because all our flying was what you call on visual flight rules. In fact, if you imagine from the bottom end of Adelaide Island looking south towards Alexander Island, I think that distance was well over 100 miles. And in the mornings, if we could see the mountains on Alexander Island, we could virtually reckon on having 12 hours of reasonable weather. Occasionally we'd get a bit of sea fog coming up, we didn't really have to operate in those conditions.
So although you didn't have weather forecasting to speak of, you could work out how long you had.
Oh yeah, well, in the mornings we did, we had weather schedules with the bases like Stonington Island and Fossil Bluff. And we'd get all the weather down in the south, and Stonington could tell us what the weather around about the middle of Marguerite Bay was. And as I said, we made up our minds. We had our skeds about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we'd lay on our program for the day.
And you were flying out of Deception all the time, or flying?
No, All the summer operating was done from Adelaide Island, the base right at the tip of southern Adelaide Island. And we had an aircraft sort of park with fuel on the ice pavement there. And we had a muskeg for running up and down, taking up fuel and delivering stores, etc.
How reliable were they? Because I've read conflicting reports. Mustangs.
Muskegs?
Yeah.
Well, we had a lot of trouble occasionally with... in fact, at one time, one of the tracks bust on this thing, and to put a new track on it, we had to undo all the bolts on this thing. And I can't remember, but it went into hundreds
of bolts.
Bolts and nuts. And we had to undo them all and fasten on the new track and redo all these bolts, and that took several days.
So you wouldn't fly at all at that time. It would be all hands to the pump to mend the tractor?
Well, and on this particular occasion, it was during a period of bad weather where we wouldn't have been flying anyway. And when we weren't flying, we used to help the chaps on the tasks around the base.
Mm. How, on average, how much of the time could you fly? Were you able to fly half of the available time, or less, or more? Because of the weather conditions, I mean.
Weather conditions, difficult to say looking back now, but usually when we had a spell of decent weather, we could fly for 3 or 4 days, and we could, say, start at first flight, say, take off about 8 o'clock in the morning, and we'd finish at 8 o'clock in the evening. But, you know, when the weather got bad, that was when we sort of recharged our batteries. Mm.
So it was feast or famine, really?
Pardon?
It was feast or famine, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Flying-wise. Mm. Are there anything else, any other notes that you wanted to...
Well,
let's go back to your photograph album. You only go as far as page okay. one on Lake
well,
Ontario.
That was the Canadian business. This was taken going down to on the John. I went down on the John Biscoe, and we called in. I take it Bob gave you all the jet on.
I think you should tell me
the route,
if you don't mind.
Oh well, we started off in October from Southampton. We had 21 days to Montevideo. I think we had 2 or 3 nights in Monte. From there, it was 4 days from Montevideo down to Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands. Then we spent, I think, about a week in the Falklands getting kitted up and rearranging stores, etc., on the ship. Because as the ship went south, we offloaded stores at... South Georgia, Sydney Island in the South Orkneys, Hope Bay at the top end of the Antarctic Peninsula, Sydney Island, which I don't know if Sydney is still going now, but for some time that was mainly concerned with marine biology. From there we went to Deception Island. That was where we first came across our hangar. And, of course, there were no aircraft there because they were down south operating. So, from Deception, we during this time, incidentally, we were offloading stores, which amounted to 2 years' worth of stores at each of these bases. The stores were loaded into the ship's scow, and a motorboat took the stuff inshore, and we were all involved in unloading and unloading. It was quite a hefty bit of work.
So not much flying there then?
Well, we weren't doing any flying at the time because we hadn't reached Adelaide Island, where the aircraft were operating from.
You were heading to the Antarctic for the first time. Can you remember anything of your feelings about going down there, and your excitement or your concerns about taking such an unusual step?
Well, we knew quite a bit about what we were going to do because before we went down, we had a week at the Scott Polar Institute at Cambridge, the headquarters, well, it wasn't the headquarters at that time, but of the survey. But that was where we met all the chaps, and we were given a week's seminar on all the disciplines that were operating down there, down south at the time. And we met most of the people who were involved in the survey on the British side, including Sir Vivian Fuchs. And one of the greatest chaps that I can remember during that period was Sir Raymond Priestley.
Raymond?
Sir Raymond Priestley. He was involved in Scott's expedition, one of his expeditions, and the lecture he gave us during that week at Cambridge was marvellous. One of the finest lecturers I've ever listened to.
What do you remember from it?
Well, he was leading a party that were cut off, and they spent a winter living in a, I think, a sort of refuge that they built, and they spent the winter virtually eating seal meat. It was one of the real epics of the, and that's going back to the old heroic days of exploration.
And he impressed you as a man as well?
Oh, yeah, tremendous fellow. Yeah. At that time, he was, I seem to remember, he was in his early 90s at that time. One of the chaps who was with us going south was this fellow here, Ken Blakelock. You've heard of Ken, have you?
The name rings a bell, yes. Yeah. Why is he special to you?
Ken was involved in the Transantarctic expedition with Fuchs and Hillary, and he sledged across the route with a dog team.
And why is he in the boat with you now?
Well, he was heading south on, I can't remember what project Ken was involved in, but he was doing a survey, I think, on Adelaide Island. But he was a tremendous chap, in fact, there's an island called after him, Blakelock Island, on the east side of Marguerite Bay. I don't know if you ever came across
it. Again, I heard of it. What was the man, though? What is it about the man that you particularly remember, having met him and sailed with him?
Well, Ken, I would class as one of the surveyor's gentlemen, a real decent fellow, and great. We played bridge together and did during the time, and we had some great time.
So you had a little bit of training at Scott Polar before you went down, but the question was about your feelings about going down south, whether you were full of anticipation, excitement, or you were nervous about this strange expedition. What do you remember?
I wouldn't say nervous at all. No, having converted onto the aircraft, I looked forward to the job we were doing. The thing that I really did like about this job was that it was nothing to do with what I'd been doing previously in the RAF, flying jet fighters and things. And it was, the job was actually doing something, supporting somebody.
So it's more creative, more...
Well, I find it creative. And the other thing I enjoyed about this was all the chaps that we met, some of them were quite a bit younger than we were as pilots, and we found that their views on life were entirely different to what we've been brought up to in the service. And it was the first time, really, because I went straight into the service from school in 1941, and it was the first time I'd really met people who had a background of what I would call freedom. And we were in the service, we were regulated by air traffic and all the senior officers, etc. And down there, we were going to be our own bosses, and no air traffic to bother us at that time. And all the flying we were doing was hands-on stuff, and really did look forward to it.
Marked absence of red tape.
Yeah.
Is that why you chose to go?
Can
you remember?
It was, in fact, yeah. I was doing a job at that time in at Linton-on-Ouse in Yorkshire, where I was a station test pilot, and my job was being disestablished, and I was going to be put into a ground job.
Right.
And one day I saw this notice on the mess asking for volunteers for the British Antarctic Survey, and I thought, right, at least I might be able to keep on flying. So I put my name down, and to my amazement, about a fortnight later, I was called down to Air Ministry for an interview. And when I went down there, at that time I really didn't know a great deal about the survey or what have you. But when I went on the interview, there was a wing commander in charge of the board, and Sir Vivian Fuchs and Johnny Green, who at that time was the operations director. Did you ever meet Johnny Green?
No, but I know who you mean, yes.
We went through, they asked questions about career, etc., etc., and the thing that always stands out in my memory about the interview was we got on quite well with, Fuchs seemed quite an easy chap to get on with, but at one stage he said to me, I see you're married, Blair. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, what does your wife think about this? I said, well, she's threatening to divorce me.
Anyway, was that Peggy then?
Yeah.
Yeah, what did Peggy think of that?
Peggy thought I volunteered for somewhere up around the Shetland Islands, north of Scotland.
Was that because you fed her misleading information, or?
No.
No,
we had a house in Scotland at that time, and I'd been stationed in Scotland at Lookers, and I was travelling up and down at weekends from Yorkshire, and apart from going to be disestablished from flying, I'd been fed up with travelling up and down at weekends to go home. I thought, well, it's something different. Yeah, try that.
Try commuting from this one.
Yeah.
Not to put too fine a point on it, how did you break the news to Peggy?
I told her, first of all, I was going to Air Ministry for an interview, and I said, I haven't got a hope in hell in getting this job. Anyway, a fortnight, I think it was about... I got back to my station about a week or so, and I got the signal saying, you have been chosen. So I discovered subsequently that I was the third choice.
Really?
The chap who had been picked first, he withdrew for some reason, and I was a sort of third bloke on the list. So... But
we're going back in time slightly, but it doesn't matter too much. But just to fill in a bit more about your career with the RAF, you joined in 1941. Did you actually see active service in the
air? Well, I don't know if you want to break off for a little bit at this time, but if you'd like a quick read through that.
Well, because it's oral history, I'm going to have to ask you the question.
I see, yeah.
So you obviously... Well, we'll come back to that book shortly, perhaps. But in the meantime, just give me a quick thumbnail of your RAF career prior to seeing that notice on the board and heading south.
Well, I joined the service in 1941, straight from school.
So you're 18?
18. And I did my initial training in Canada, came back to this country, and I wound up, did operational training on Spitfires. And to my horror, having completed this, I was posted out to India. So it took us 6 weeks to on a troop ship going out to India. Then we were dumped in a pilot's pool in Pune. And I was there for about 6 weeks. And at that time, I think there were only about 3 Spitfire squadrons operating, and they weren't having any losses at that time, and we were just stuck there. And eventually, time when I replied to a notice on the notice board, it called for volunteers to go on Vengeance dive bombers. So I was selected for that and went up to the Northwest Frontier, Peshawar, where they had an operational training unit, completed that. Then I wound up with this dive bomber squadron in Assam, and we were operating against the Japanese around the Imphal area.
In Nagaland?
No, Assam. right up in the northeast of India, near Imphal. And I operated there for some time, and eventually when we'd pushed the Japanese down through the Imphal plain, and we were pushing them back towards Burma, and we were told that the squadron was being withdrawn at that time, and the squadron was going to convert onto mosquitoes. So we were withdrawn from the front at in the northeast, and we went back down to India, and we got stuck there for I think about a month, and it was just at the beginning of the monsoon period, and we weren't getting much flying or anything, and there was no sign of these mosquitoes arriving, but five of us were suddenly detached to the West Africa to carry out experimental work on DDT spraying. This was quite unusual at that time, because out in the Far East, our army people, the majority of the casualties really were being caused by malaria. Hmm. And the powers that be in this country decided that they'd better find out some method of dispensing with mosquitoes. So we flew five of the aircraft from airfield we were at just outside Bombay. We flew five of the aircraft across to West Africa, and we were joined by an outfit from Port and Down, which is a chemical warfare outfit, and they marked out areas of jungles, went in, counted the mosquitoes, etc., and we went and sprayed them, and we did this for 3 months. And at the end of that, we were supposed to go back to India to convert with the squadron. Excuse me a minute. we were suddenly called in one morning, and our boss said to us, there's a ship out there, chaps, you're on your way back to UK. And all the crews on the detachment were shoveled off back to UK. And we arrived back in Liverpool on Old Year's Night, 1944. We were given 14 days disembarkation leave. And at the end of that, I was recalled. I got 10 days eventually. I was recalled and given a very swift conversion onto Typhoons. And I think I was given about 12 and a half hours conversion time on the aircraft. I fired 8 rockets. I never fired the cannons. And I was shipped out to Holland, joined the Typhoon squadron in Holland. In fact, there were 3 of us from the squadron joined. And on the first day that we operated, one of the chaps was shot down on his first trip. Okay. And that's another story. I won't bore you with that one. But anyway, I flew with 183 squadron, and we switched from rocketing to dive bombing, and we flew right up through Holland, Germany, and I wound up in Germany at the end of the war at Wunstorf. From there, the squadron was drawn to 11 Group, to a base just outside Winchester, a place called Chilbolton. And there we converted back onto Spitfires. We had those for about 2 or 3 weeks. Then we got the first Tempest 2s. And we were to be one of the squadrons designated to go back out to the Far East on the Japanese thing, because the Japanese war at that time was still going. Mm. We weren't all that keen on that, but eventually when the Japanese war finished, in fact, that was the day I met my wife in Winchester. We met on VJ Day.
So after all that, the Antarctic didn't hold too many horrors for you then, really?
No, and from there I went to That's right. I decided that I wanted to stay in the service then. I'm not going on too
far. No, it's fine. I'll move you along there for me. Yeah.
I decided I wanted to stay in the service anyway, but after that I did 4 years of basic instructing, and from there I did a conversion onto jets. I went on to Vampires, and I flew Vampires out in Germany again for 2.5 years. Then after that I was posted to a ferry squadron at Abingdon. And from there, we spent a year ferrying sabres, which the Canadian government had presented us with. They gave the RAF 400 sabres, and we ferried them from Canada to UK. After that, I was posted to Headquarters 12 Group, my first ground job, which I thoroughly enjoyed because I was flying all weekend looking after... But my job there was looking after the weapons training of the auxiliary squadrons at that time, and I was flying all over the country and onto the continent. So I quite enjoyed that one. After that, I went on to the Air Fighting Development Squadron at that Central Fighter Establishment. I had 2.5 years there, and after that, I was given another ground job, and I became flying wing adjutant. No, a weapons officer at RAF Lookers. That's when I first moved to Scotland. from Lookers, when I completed there, I was posted down to this place at Linton-on-Ouse, and that's where I...
saw the notice.
Saw the notice again about going to the Antarctic.
All right, well, we're in the Antarctic, and these photographs would have been taken in 1960... Yep. What year are we talking
62.
About now?
62. These were in 62. This was where on the Piedmont there, where we had our aircraft. This flag, incidentally, is now up at London Colney.
Where?
London Colney, where the otter's gone.
Oh, right. This is the UK, the United Kingdom flag.
That's right.
That was flying above... That
flag marked our fuel depot, and we also used the flag as a windsock. Sort of windsock.
Yeah. We're not going to have time to look at all these, David, so do you want to pick on a couple of classics, perhaps?
Okay.
These were all taken by you or your colleagues at the time?
Yep. There's our most... this is Ken Blakelock again. Abe Lincoln, who spent the time with... Bob Bond.
Oh, yes.
Abe apparently died last year, which Bob probably told you about that, didn't
he? No, I didn't, no.
This was a fellow Pfeiffer this chap did quite a number of thousands of miles sledging down in the Antarctic, Ron Tyndall. I flew him down to Fossil Bluff on occasions. This was me with a...
With a beard? You were flying dogs around as well, were you?
Oh, yeah.
Was that something that was a...
That was... my first experience of flying with dogs was quite amusing. The way we flew them... Sorry.
No, it's fine. Fine, carry on.
The way we flew them, we had a dog sledge right up the middle of the cabin, and the dogs were pegged on... around the cabin, and usually I think there was a team of about 7 dogs, and they would be pegged down all around the cabin, and we had the dog handler and either a geologist or surveyor usually with the team, including all their man boxes and dog food, etc. But the first team I flew was going from Adelaide Island down to Fossil Bluff. And I was flying along, and I suddenly felt something warm on my thigh. And I looked down, and there was this huge head of a husky, and he'd pulled his collar right around the cabin and rested his head on my thigh. He must have been absolutely choking himself, but he spent the whole trip like that. And looking down at this dog, he only had one eye. He was an old chap called Steve, and he was one of the loveliest dogs I've ever come across.
Was he the leader?
He wasn't a lead dog at that time, but he has a history which I could go into tell you later on. It's most interesting history. But he was pensioned off into the old dog team at Deception Island at the end of this particular season, and I used to go out on skis with him on a rope.
On Deception?
On Deception Island.
For recreational purposes?
Oh, yeah. This is one of the depots that we laid up in the Batterby Mountains, just the east of Possil Bluff. That's on the plateau, about 4,000 feet above sea level.
These are just simply wooden crates held together with wire, stacked up about the height of a man, and then a couple of very poles, twice as high.
These are all man food and dog food boxes.
Would that have become snowed over, would it?
During the winter time, I don't really know, because I think that this depot had been started the previous year, and usually we try to lay them in places where the snow wouldn't accumulate too much around them.
Again, just one or two of your highlight photographs.
That's one of the dog teams. This was at Possil Bluff. It's King George's Sixth Sound.
These are lovely black and white photographs taken with what, David? Do you remember?
I had, I can't remember what camera it was. It was a Japanese thing, Canon. It was a Canon. This is one of our dogs that had pups down on the base at Adelaide Island.
For somebody who spent most of his time flying, you obviously had quite an affinity with the Huskies.
Oh, yeah. These were the pups 6 months from after they were born. This is Mount Godfrey on Island, Adelaide Island. You probably remember that. That was one that was climbed by John Green and a company of Marines from HMS Protector. The first season that we were down there, we stayed in this hut, which was called Stevenson Hut, and we stayed in the loft. That's what it looked like. We slept on the floor in the attic. And I found it personally quite inconvenient, because we would be flying, say, from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock in the evening, and next door there was an office with a couple of typewriters on, when the chaps we brought back from the field would be sitting chatting all night and typing up their reports whilst we were trying to get some sleep. I had occasion to write to the operations director and suggest that the following season the air unit would occupy this hut, which was called, I can't remember the name of it, and there was a new accommodation hut being built, which this is it here, and suggested that the air unit for the following season we would operate from this hut and be self-containing, doing our own cooking and etc. We weren't trying to divorce ourselves from the rest of the rest of the base team, but it was something we felt we needed to get sufficient rest in during the periods when we weren't flying.
So relationships between flyers and non-flyers was fairly cordial most of the time?
Oh, yeah.
All the time?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got on well with all the chaps on the bases. This was our dentist who went down with us, Dave Bennion. It was me having a tooth filled, which I'd lost a filling during the winter. And our diesel mechanic spent the winter putting temporary fillings in for me. And this was the actual dentist operating from the Mustang garage at Adelaide Island.
And he was putting in a permanent filling?
Yeah.
How much fear was attached to not going to the dentist, but the one thing that you couldn't do, whilst you were isolated down there, if anything went wrong with your body, particularly over the winter, there wasn't a lot anybody could do about it. Was that something that was always at the back of your mind?
Did
toothache worry you?
Yeah, before we went down, everyone was... in fact, before I went down, I think all the fillings I had were all renewed and inspected by the survey dentist in London before we went down. Unfortunately, one of my fillings dropped out, probably due to the low temperature, and this was the result.
So that was standard practice, was it, that the new recruits had their fillings checked out before being sent south?
Yes, very much so.
All right.
In fact, on the Argentinian base and the Chilean bases on Deception Island, all the chaps, before they went down south, all had their appendix removed.
That's beyond the call of duty, surely.
Always waiting for your break, yeah.
Shall we take a break?
If you like.
I think we will. Thank you very much, Peggy. Thank you.
Sorry, I've been going on.
No, that's exactly what you're supposed to be doing.
This is David Blair, recorded at his home near Paignton in Devon by Chris Eldon Lee on the 12th of February, 2006. David Blair, Part 2.
David, let's pick up from where we left off, if we may.
Mm-hmm.
There were one or two little anecdotes that you mentioned whilst we were having our coffee break. First of all, you mentioned about flying coal around. Tell me about that. You mentioned about flying coal around.
Oh, yeah.
And you had a nickname.
Well, one of the tasks we had in resupplying the southern base at Fossil Bluff was resupplying the coal stocks. We carried coal in double-skinned Hessian bags, and I think, if I remember correctly, each bag weighed 34 pounds, and I can't remember offhand how many we carried, but we had a full load. And at the end of it, our faces were pretty black like coal men. And at that time, we reckoned that we must have been the highest paid coal men in the world.
There's also a story about flying the dogs above a certain altitude.
Well, during the summer, where the dogs were all pegged out at Adelaide Island, they were fed on raw seal meat. And raw seal meat, when it goes through the gastric system, what comes out the other end is rather, I would say, nauseous. And flying or climbing up, going through 5,000 feet approximately, climbing up to 10,000 feet to get over the Antarctic Peninsula, the dogs' gases in their stomachs swelled, and the stench that came out was almost unbelievable. On the first trip I did with Abe Lincoln, we wound up with our noses stuck outside the side windows. It was so bad. It really was quite nauseating.
You'd rather have a frostbitten nose, would you?
Well, I say that
tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
Tell me about Abe Lincoln, because you've mentioned him several times now.
Abe Lincoln was a New Zealander, Royal Air Force pilot, flight lieutenant, and from the history that I can remember of his service career, he flew Sunderlands with the Coastal Command, and before he joined the survey, he flew Shackleton's on Coastal Command work.
And what sort of man was he to work with? You knew him.
Great chap. I got on very well with Abe. Nice chap, very keen worker, very dedicated to the job. And he certainly put me right in many directions.
How do you mean?
Loading the aircraft, loading the boxes, getting dogs on and off, and how to load the sledges, etc. And generally showing me the local area, almost what you call a sector recce. It took me to Fossil Bluff, then Stonington Island. And we had one memorable trip where we were trying to get a dog team or two dog teams over onto the east coast of the peninsula. And we started off in gorgeous weather from Adelaide Island. We climbed up to about 12,000 feet. And when we got onto the east coast, we started to encounter cloud. And Abe let down on a DR position. And as we got lower and lower, it started snowing. And it became quite obvious to me that I thought, well, we're not going to see any surface going down to this. And we had 294, the other aircraft, in company with us. And we lost him. He couldn't keep contact with us on the descent with all the snow. And eventually I said to Abe, hey, let's get out of here. And we packed up and had to climb back up. On the climbing back up, the other aircraft, 294, which was the older aircraft, had some difficulty getting regaining altitude, particularly with picking up a little bit of snow on the... Fortunately, the icing wasn't building up to any great extent, but it was sufficient to reduce the rate of climb on 294 to, I think, somewhere in the region of about 100 feet a minute. And he had quite a job getting enough altitude to get back across onto the west coast.
But you both made it, obviously.
Oh, yeah, we both made it back. But had we continued our letdown, I'm sure both of us would have crashed.
Did you fly most of your operations with Abe? Was it a partnership?
No, no. What happened was when we arrived at Adelaide Island, Bob Bond, who was a senior pilot, I don't think he was a senior pilot actually, but Bob checked me out on skis. I did a few circuits and landings around Adelaide Island. Then after that, Bob, who had done two winters and a couple of, about four summers down there, I think he'd had quite enough. And he took himself off and joined the John Biscoe. The other pilot who went down with me, Bill Stutt, he had an unfortunate accident. They were out on a run with the dogs one day, and he fell off the sledge and broke a rib, which put him out of action for some time. And during that period, Abe kept on flying and did most of his, took over most of his tasks. When he recovered, when Bill Stutt recovered, Abe then took himself off onto the ship, and we were left, the two new boys, more or less, continuing to the end of that season.
But I'm right in thinking that you always flew in pairs. You'd never fly solo?
No. Oh, no.
Is that written down somewhere, or just common sense?
During the second, at the end of our winter at Deception Island, we had the aircraft pegged out outside the hangar, and we had weather schedules from the Falkland Islands, and we prepared our own pre-baratic charts. And we had weather schedules with Argentine Islands and Adelaide Island to get weather to do the ferry trip from Deception back down to Adelaide. Now, whilst we were waiting for this weather, we had, unfortunately, a storm blew up. Wind was gusting up over 90 knots, and both the aircraft were quite badly damaged. The tail elevators and the tails, or the rudders actually, were so badly damaged that it put the aircraft out of action. Fortunately, we had sufficient spares in the hangar at that time. We managed to get 3-7-7 back into action, and unfortunately, we had to wait until we got parts down from Canada to replace the broken bits on 294. And we had to wait for the arrival of the first ship to bring these bits down for us. These spares were delivered from de Havilland's in Toronto down to Montevideo, and they were collected by I think it was the Shackleton brought the bits we needed, and she was the first ship that got back in to Deception.
But even then, there's no temptation whatsoever to fly solo.
Well, we would have done, but we were informed by the survey that unless both aircraft were serviceable, that was it.
You couldn't go at all.
Well, we did, in fact. We carried out ice recces with 377 for the ships to get in, delivering the spares.
But the principle was that you had to have a second plane on standby.
Ideally,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, but that was broken when you were desperate for these spares.
Well, occasionally we flew both aircraft. In fact, it was only one occasion, I think, where you'll see on the photographs there, both aircraft. That's at Deception Island. In transit, we flew the aircraft together as much as we could, but otherwise, it was individual trips.
I got the impression from somewhere that the two planes would never fly side by side anywhere because they would both get caught up in the same weather. They were always at the opposite end of the run. Would that be true, or is that not your memory?
Didn't work out that way with us.
Well,
on the transit, there's a picture showing the transit. That was us going north back to Deception Island. That's Mount Francis on Enver's Island there.
And both planes side by side flying together.
Yeah.
I guess that was in perfect conditions.
That was. We wound up, incidentally, on that trip down to 500 feet, crossing out from the peninsula across the water to Deception Island.
There's mention in Ice and Men that some of the pilots likened it to bush flying. Does that ring a bell with you? Is that something you would say?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Mm. What is there about bush flying which is similar to the Antarctic?
Well, more or less you're on your own. Fortunately, we didn't have, touch wood, we didn't have any real serious engine failures.
Yeah.
We had occasionally, on 377, we had what we call a live magneto, which is the magneto is permanently live, and when the engines get cold, the propellers have got to be turned by hand. And turning the propellers with a live magneto is almost akin to expecting to have your head chopped off.
were there hairy moments? Moments when they had passed, you thought to yourself, "Well, that was lucky."
We were. In fact, there was one day we were heading down to Fossil Bluff, and Bill Stutt, for some reason, was behind me, and I was just coming up onto the shelf ice in King George VI Sound, and Bill was roughly a beam Stonington Island, and he called me up and said, "Hey," he said, "I've got a smell of burning in the aircraft." He thought it was on fire, so he said, "What shall I do?" And I suggested it would be a good idea if he diverted to Stonington. But the burning went away. It was an electrical fire, and whatever it was, it burned itself out. But that was the nearest one, I think, that I can recall. The other hairy one we had was at the end of our first season, when we were flying back to Deception Island. We started off in absolutely gin-clear weather, and as we headed north, by the time we got up past Argentine Islands, it was pretty obvious that we were running into a form of low pressure or a front as we started descending. And when we got up to this position here, to head across the Branfield Strait, we wound up down to about a couple hundred feet, and we were dodging icebergs, and we were getting a build-up of ice on the wings. And it got so hairy that we thought, right, that's it. End of trip. So we had to 180 backtrack and fly all the way back down to Adelaide. That flight took us, I think it was 6.5 hours.
To go nowhere?
We were airborne. We got up to there, which was about 20 miles short of Adelaide, out to Deception Island, and that was it, bang.
You had to fly back out of the weather again.
We had to fly back out of the weather, and when we got back to Adelaide Island down here, the weather was gorgeous again.
Did you come across any maintenance headaches with the planes?
Yeah, during the second season we were there, 294 developed severe oil leaks, and we wound up changing three cylinders in the field. And that took us, I think that took us nearly a fortnight. Working, you know, with mechanics working out in the field, we wound up with our feet in We had a pool of oil under our feet. Roughly halfway up to our knees, and we could only work when the wind was below about. We could only work when the wind was about below about 2 knots. Mm. If it got over 2 knots, that was it. It just became too cold for the mechanics to handle the tools.
And when they say in the field, do you literally mean in the field, or do you mean at Adelaide, or do you mean
at Adelaide, which I would say was in the field.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah, and the routine maintenance, presumably icing was a problem all the time, was it, or not?
Icing, yep. If we were laid up for a couple of days and we wanted to start flying again, we'd find that the aircraft was covered in snow. We had brushes, which we had to climb up over the wings and knock all this ice and snow off before we could even think of flying.
Mm. And the cold temperature operations, would that affect the diesel or the oil or the fluids in the plane?
Yeah, well, the fuel that we used all came down on the ships in, I think there were 80-gallon drums. And these were pumped by wobble pumps from the cans into the aircraft. The system of the tankage in the auto was a little bit difficult because hand pumping this stuff became a bit tricky. So I devised a method of clamping a filter onto the wing struts, and we pumped fuel from the cans up into this filter, and it came fed down by gravity into the tanks, and it made the job quite a bit easier. In fact, on one trip, I had water in the fuel system, and it caused severe backfiring. I was on a trip when we were trying to take one of the dog teams over to the East Coast, and we got up over the middle of the peninsula, and the engine suddenly stopped firing for a few seconds, and it go off again with a mighty bang, and it's a... obvious signs of water in the fuel system.
And how are the dogs reacting?
I was a bit too concerned at the time to worry about the dogs. On that occasion, I thought it was prudent not to continue across the plateau onto the east coast, and I diverted onto the glacier at Stonington Island, where we drained the fuel filters.
So you had to filter the fuel before it got into the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way of doing this was to pump it up and let it drop down through the plane's wing supports through a filter in there somewhere.
Not in the filter. We had a hose attached from the filter, which we directed into the tanks.
Right. Okay. How were the otters to handle in the Antarctic? Were they good at being in those kind of conditions?
Well, an otter with a full load, taking off, say, almost at sea level at Adelaide Island, to understand the aerodynamics of flying with a full load, there's what you call a drag curve, and... you've got to get on the right side of the drag curve to get any speed going. Well, having taken off from, say, the likes of Adelaide Island, we had to fly at continuous maximum power for about, maximum continuous power for about 5 minutes to get over the hump, as it were, on this drag curve. Once you got over the hump the aircraft would settle down quite nicely and cruise along quite well.
So was that heart-in-your-mouth time, often, occasionally?
Not really, no.
You just knew it would be all right?
Just knew it. It was one of the things you had to do.
And once you were up there, were they light to touch?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, when we flew, we always had another person in the... in the second pilot seat, and I think quite a few of the FIDs we taught to fly straight and level.
That was unofficial, I guess.
Well, I suppose it was.
did the FIDs actually jockey for position for the opportunity to fly with you?
Not really, I don't think.
There was no sort of clamouring for a trip out?
Occasionally, when we were doing air tests, say from Deception Island, at the end of the servicing season, we gave all the chaps on the base a good run round, and they like to come out and have a look at the ships from the air.
Mm. We talked a little bit about coping with risks as they cropped up. Were there any occasions where you took a risk knowing it was a risk beforehand?
Yes, I remember the final trip that I did from Fossil Bluff. If you can imagine, Fossil Bluff sat at the bottom of at the side of a ridge, and there was a lot of... scree blown off that onto King George VI Sound, and during the summertime, where all the scree landed, it caused a melt. And if you could imagine, it formed pools, undulating pools, and we found that we had, having landed at Fossil Bluff, to find a place for it to take off that was relatively smooth, we had to taxi quite a long way down the Sound. But towards the end of the season, I remember the last takeoff I did, I was jolly glad when I finally got airborne. And Bill Stutsby was flying with me that day in 294. He broke one of his skis on the final sort of lurch before he got airborne.
This is because there was water there forming. No, this is because it was getting too...
Because it became so undulating. It wasn't just like sastrugi. This was real sort of dips in there. If you could imagine a runway with great hollows sort of suddenly appearing, rather like that.
But again, you had no choice but to leave.
No.
You didn't want to spend all winter there.
No. Yeah, we had horrible thoughts of if something goes wrong, if we're praying on this, that's it. We're stuck there for the winter.
Yeah. But you wintered on Deception, didn't you?
Yeah.
How was that for you? What was it like psychologically, knowing that there was not much to do now at all?
Well, there was plenty to do. I mean, we had all the maintenance on the aircraft to do. And we, in the hangar, we had a little sort of caboose at one side. And we had, I think we had two or three paraffin stoves going on this. And we kept them running 24 hours a day. And if you imagine the amount of moisture that comes off of burning paraffin at the end of the winter, the inside of this office was covered in ice. And during the, you know, when the engineers were working on the aircraft, the other pilot and myself were virtually tool boys, and we kept heating up tools on these stoves and rushing out into the hangar to give it to the engineers and retrieving them when they got cold.
Why was it good to have the tools warm? Was that wasn't just for comfort?
It was necessary. I mean, if you handle metal at temperatures below zero, the metal will stick to your hands.
So there were no gloves involved?
Well, on some occasions when, it wasn't possible to... part of the maintenance they were doing, they couldn't do it with gloves on. We did have... a hot air machine called the Noco, and it was a bit of a devil, this thing.
How do you mean?
To start it up in sort of below zero temperatures, it was like, if you've ever had experience in lighting a Primus stove, it was similar to that. But we had to preheat the burner on this thing with methylated spirit. And if we didn't get the temperature right, once this thing got going, occasionally we got a huge backfire which just about blew all the windows out.
you showed me a letter from Antarctica Calling. This was the radio programme.
Yeah.
And you were on the receiving end of this, I think, weren't you? Tell me about that story.
Well, during the winter months, BBC World Service, I think, at that time, they produced a programme called Calling Antarctica, and it came out every Tuesday during the winter months, and it went through each base. All the personnel on the base went through everybody alphabetically, and... there were messages sent from all the relatives who wished to participate. So every Tuesday night, all the chaps used to congregate after the evening meal and listen to their... and it involved not just the base you were particularly based at, all the other bases. And... we got all these personal messages, which some were quite funny, and others were pretty awful. One friend of mine had got the unfortunate news that his father had died, and that put a real damper on the things.
This was transmitted on the wireless. This was how he learned, knowing that everybody else was hearing the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tough, isn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that we, during the evening, we had schedules where we could speak to the other bases, like from Deception Island in the winter, we could speak to, for instance, Halley Bay, which was at the other end of the Weddell Sea. We could speak to the base at Hope Bay, Sydney Island, Argentine Islands, and the chaps at Adelaide and Stonington, and as far as the Bluff.
But you'd all be listening at the same time on Tuesday night to Calling Antarctica. And I think your number came up once, didn't it?
Yep, and as, like everybody else, it's quite embarrassing. But
why was it embarrassing?
Well, just, you know, hearing a voice that you knew, and, you know, some personal things that come out, and you feel yourself sort of cringing a bit.
This was Peggy going into the BBC at Edinburgh?
No, no, the BBC chap came to the house and did the recording at home.
Oh, right.
And I think this was prevalent throughout the whole programme. But on top of that, as I was mentioning the other bases, we used to have these schedules, and the evening time when bases spoke to each other, it was called the Goon Show. And you know, there was a lot of badinage sort of going around. It was good, quite good fun.
So we were talking about looking after the planes and the work you're doing in the winter, and presumably there was some work to be done as this flying season approached, which had to be the planes had to be reinstated. I think they were partly dismantled, weren't they?
The only thing we had to do, as far as the aircraft was concerned, was to get the aircraft into the hangars. We had to take the skis off. We taxied the aircraft up to the hangar, right into the hangar door, virtually. Then the skis were taken off, and the aircraft were jacked up and put on big cradle things with casters on them, and they were manhandled into position in the hangar, pushing them on the base. When they were doing that, we had quite a lot of manpower on the base, because the wintering party, we only had 10 people there.
So the planes would come out before the ships arrived in the spring.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And how?
In fact, if the aircraft hadn't been damaged at the end of my winter, we would have been off flying in probably about the end of July.
Oh, right.
We didn't get airborne until, into, I think it was December.
Oh, really? As late as that? Simply waiting for spares?
Yeah.
Yeah. Frustrating.
Yeah, very frustrating. I mean, when we surveyed the damage caused by that gale, it put the real, you know, you thought, oh my God, you know, how are we going to get over this?
And presumably, Fossil Bluff and Adelaide Island were waiting for you to turn up with post and...
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, frustrating for them too.
Yeah. In fact, during that winter, we had the dentist chap that I showed you operating on my teeth there. He fell down a crevasse at Stonington Island, and this other chum friend of mine, Ron Tyndall, put 32 stitches in his head.
Oh.
he nearly bought it, this chap. Yeah. And he laid in the bottom of this crevasse for quite a long time.
So you're wintering in Deception, and for rather longer than you hoped because of the shortage of supply of spare parts. Joanna seems to think you might have one or two more stories about that winter period in Deception.
Now, one of the things that we did, actually, I don't know if Bob brought this up, about one of the big chores in down south was getting cutting snow blocks to put in melt tanks to provide water for cooking and washing. At Deception, we had a Met man who figured that we could, if we dug a well, we could have fresh water. We decided, had a meeting one Saturday night, and we thought, let's have a go at digging this well. And we had a chap on the base at the time, a chap called Dick Stocks, who was one of the FIDS builders, who was an ex, worked on diamond mines in South Africa. or gold mines, I can't remember which. But eventually it was decided we'd have a go at digging this well, and we cut it. John Tate was one of the chief movers on this, and we made a trap door in the bathroom, a fairly wide trap door, lifted that up, and we started digging. And we had we dug with two ice axes and fondue cement buckets, which were about a couple of feet deep and about maybe a foot or so wide. And we had started down, and eventually we got down to about, I think we were down to about 18 feet. And as we went down, this chum Dick Stocks, getting wood and stuff from the old whaling factory at Deception, he shored the well up as we went down. But it was a bit horrible, sort of, being down there, the chaps up top who were pulling these buckets up and down, sprinkled the odd bit down on your head. You thought, Christ, this is going to collapse, you know. It's a bit of a claustrophobic feeling. Anyway, we went down, I think we got down somewhere around about 20-odd feet, and we suddenly hit solid stone. And we thought, what are we going to do now? And we had no way of discovering how big the stone was. And eventually we found the edge. And this chum, Dick put a concrete collar around the thing, and the well actually moved sideways about 3 feet. And we went down the side of the stone down to about 24 feet, and we struck water. Now, it transpired that this water was fresh, and it was at a constant temperature of 56 degrees.
Gosh.
So we thought, great, we've got fresh water, and we had to dig down another 4 feet to build a sump. And we thought it was great, and we thought, all we've got to do now is pump this up to the surface. And that's where the problem started. We started with a manual wobble pump, and we found that we could only carry the water up so high with this, and the pump had to be primed every time, and it became, you know, really quite a chore. One of the chaps on the base discovered that in the attic of the old hut there was an electric pump. So we got this pump mounted on the concrete collar that that we had built on the way down, and we were pumping water up. But the strange thing about this was that we discovered that the amount of water that we held in the sump depended on the tide. At high water, the level of water backed up into the sump, but at low water, all the sump emptied. So we wound up having to do all our pumping at high water.
Even though it was fresh?
Yeah.
How unusual.
Now, the Chilean Air Force base on the island, they were so impressed with this well that they got round to digging one. But when they got down to below the melt level, below the permafrost, got into their thing, theirs was salt water.
Really? And they were not far away?
No.
So the inspiration was vindicated, but it was lucky, was it?
I think we, in many ways, we were lucky, because we had Mount Pond behind us. You probably recall that from your visit to Deception. And the melt stream underneath the permafrost obviously ran down and into the bay.
And this water was drunk or washing? Or
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was perfectly fresh water, and we used it for washing, bathing, and cooking.
And no more you needed no longer to go outside and cut ice or snow.
Yeah, that was absolute.
All mod cons.
Yeah, great. Yeah, we eventually had Somebody else found a great lengths of or coils of polythene piping, polystyrene piping.
Polyurethane.
And we had the electric pump attached where we could switch over from the melt. We pumped into the melt tanks in the bathroom and the kitchen. And by switching valves, we kept both tanks filled. Marvellous.
Did the pilots have to do their turn at cooking?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. During the winter, we had what we called a sort of gas roster, and you started at the bottom end of the roster, cleaning out, keeping the corridors clean. And coal had to be, one of the other duties was bringing coal in for the week. We had a bar at Deception Island, which we kept going very nicely. And every week we had a ration of spirits and beer. And on Saturday nights we used to start off with a darts competition.
Oh, really? I've not heard about this.
Oh, yeah. We ran this darts competition every Saturday night, and it became quite a sort of needle matching. And at the end of the season, or the end of the winter, most of the chaps could throw quite a reasonable dart.
Would this become international competition from time to time? With the Chilean and Argentinian bases?
No, not as far as the darts went, but we used to ski around the island to visit the other two bases. We'd start off one day and ski around to the Chilean Air Force base, spend a night with them, then go right round to the other side of the island and spend maybe a night or two with the Argentine Navy outfit. Mm. But the Argentinians were great because they had deep freezes full of proper Argentinian beefsteaks. And being able to eat beefsteaks was absolutely marvellous. But towards the end of the winter, the Argies, I think their deep freezes went for Burton, and they wound up having to eat seal meat like we did.
Mm. Your time, you were there for one full, let me get this right, you were there for over a year, for about 18 months in total.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't stay for a second winter.
No.
Was that part of the plan, or was that a change of plan?
Well, when Bob and Abe were down, they spent two winters there, and there was a change of plan. Whether it came from the Air Ministry, I don't know. But we were only scheduled to go there for the one winter. And as far as I know, they kept to that.
How did you feel about life as your time down there came to a close?
Well, obviously I was looking forward to getting back again, back home with a wife and children. Mm.
So when you came back, during that period, were you still always an RAF employee?
Oh, yes.
Mm. You hadn't been seconded or...?
Well, we were seconded to the survey.
Yeah. So what happened to you when you came back? What was the next step in your rather unusual career pattern?
Interview at Air Ministry and said, where are you going next? And I was told, I decided when I was down there that I felt I'd done my time in the service. I didn't think I was going to be promoted to any great level. And having tasted freedom from discipline, etc., I decided that my next posting was probably going to be my last. So I wanted to be back near my home, and I got a posting to Lucher.
Right.
And I spent my final time in the service at RAF Lucas as the flying wing agent.
And so you stepped out of the RAF at what age would that be?
I retired at 65. I must have been 65.
Well, you'd be in your late 30s, I guess.
That's
you?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I retired at 42, I think. I was 42 when I retired.
From the RAF.
Mm.
And then what?
After that, I went. I became a civilian flying instructor. I took a civilian license, and I spent 14 and a half years instructing at Air Service Training at Perth.
Oh, right. So a lifetime of planes, then, really?
But
a lifetime with planes.
Oh yeah.
And do you still have connections with the flying world now?
Yes. Oh yeah.
And what's
When I got a bit long in the tooth instructing at Perth, I managed to get a contract to flying out in Saudi Arabia for 3 years with an English company. And at the end of that, at that time, I don't think there were all that many pilots of my sort of age, and I found when I came up to the age of 60, one was no longer able to occupy the left-hand seat on public transport.
Mm.
So it was okay instructing. So I managed, by this time I was sort of running down a bit. I did a lot of part-time instructing with the Exeter Flying Club and Airways Flight Training at Exeter.
Some people I talk to regard that their time in the Antarctic as a real special part of their life.
Oh, yeah.
How do you view it now? Back at it?
Something really that I'd hated to have missed. It was I look back on it with great fondness.
And what is it about it which you're glad you didn't miss? Is it this word freedom you keep using, or?
I'm sorry.
What is it about it that was so special? Is it you mentioned the word freedom?
Yeah.
That was it, really. Two or three times you mentioned that.
Freedom, virtually. Well, it wasn't all freedom, but it was mostly being able to be your own boss, more or less.
Mm. Did you feel, again, this is something that one or two people have spoken about, that apart from the obvious beauty of the place, did you feel any other kind of inspiration or spiritual input from your time in the Antarctic?
Yeah, well, on each base, they had a very comprehensive libraries, and during my winter down there, I read practically every book that's ever been published on the Antarctic. And, one felt being a part of it was great. For instance, I don't know if you've heard anything of the Finn Ronny expeditions on Stonington Island.
Mm-hmm.
You have?
Yeah.
Well, even mentioning things like you've probably heard of Jenny's Bog. There's Jenny, memories.
Is this the American commander's?
That's right, wife.
Yeah.
Jenny Darlington, I think
that's
the name was.
Yes, well done. Yeah.
Yeah. So the old brain's still fairly active. Yeah, having been around and feeling to have been a part of that sort of thing, and the other great chap, Lincoln Ellsworth, you've heard of him, whose great icon was Wyatt Earp. He flew across the Atlantic, the Antarctic, carrying Wyatt Earp's two revolvers.
So is this sense of connection with a very special group of people, perhaps, or a special part of our heritage?
Mm.
Yeah. Will you go again?
Well, since I stopped flying, I've had a quadruple bypass. And I don't think that anybody, insurance-wise, would look at me twice now, apart from feeling quite fit. But I would love to go down again, yes.
One of the otter planes that was left at Deception is now being removed from the Antarctic. and has come back to this country. Does that have any special feeling meaning for you?
Yes, I should look forward to seeing it again. But having seen the picture of it taken, lying abandoned outside the hangar at Deception Island, I would be quite amazed if they get it back to looking anything like its former self.
What, have they got it off the ground again? Would you go up?
Not in that one. No.
Why not?
Hmm? Well, it was getting a bit tired when I left it. Yeah, I think it was... I don't know how many engine changes it had when they finally packed it in, but I think the airframe was getting a little bit tired as well. Mm. But there had been so much vandalism carried out on the thing that virtually all that was left there was a shell. Mm. Mm. Did you get that impression?
Yes, yes, very much so, yes. Mm. Yeah.
So, but it's amazing what these aircraft restorers can do these days. Extraordinary. Did you ever come across or hear of George MacLeod?
No, tell me.
George was spent the winter at Fossil Bluff during the winter I was down there, and early in the season, he and a chap called Ralph Horn, who was a geologist. He and George were sledging down King George's Sixth Sound, and what they used to do in the mornings, they'd sort of get the sledge going, all packed up, sledge going, and they would go on till what they called their smoker, and that was the early morning break, and they'd stop and have the break, then. At that during that period, they'd peg the dogs down on the snow, and they would carry on. Well, they'd been doing this, going up this glacier, and being in a glacier region, Ralph was was skiing ahead of the dogs, and he was attached to the dog lead, or the lead dog, with a long rope, and he was sort of going along on his skis, and he was suddenly jerked off his feet. And he looked back, and the dogs were fighting as they do. There's a great mass of dogs all having at each other. And he thought, what the heck's George doing? And he went back. No signs of George. George had disappeared. And it took him, he reckoned, about... 20 minutes to sort the dogs out and get them pegged down, and he couldn't see any signs of George anywhere. So he attached himself to the sledge with a rope and skied back along the tracks, and he found a hole, and George had disappeared. What had happened, they'd stopped for the smoker. And when they started off again, normally the chap driving the dogs attached himself to the sledge with a carabiner thing, and he'd forgotten to do this. And he fell down this crevasse. Now, Ralph had no idea how deep this thing was, or you know where George was. And he got up to the edge of this thing and shouted down, and... his voice just, there was no reply. And he thought, oh my God, I've lost him. Anyway, he got the dogs sorted out, brought them back to the edge of the crevasse, and fortunately he had lots of rope, and he let down a length of rope with a... You heard of these Jumar climbing stirrups? It's a sort of stirrup thing that you attach to a rope. It's got loops on it, and you stick your feet in, and you work your way up the rope. Anyway, he lowered this rope with these two stirrups on it, and went down, and you know, still shouting, no reply. And he said he felt this the rope tautened, and it became obvious that George was attached to the other end of it and was climbing up. But as he climbed up, the rope cut into the lip of the crevasse, and he got up right to virtually the shoulder of the thing, and he couldn't get through. And he was so weak by this time that, and he's bleeding profusely from a big cut in his cheek. he'd also hurt his shoulder on his way down, and they managed to get into voice contact. And George said to Ralph, "I'm sorry," he said, I can't do this anymore." He said, "I'm going to have to go back down and rest." And he disappeared back down the crevasse again and started, and he waited, I think, for about half an hour. And he started climbing up again, and he got back to the same place and just couldn't get any further. And eventually Ralph unhooked the dogs, got them up, and he pulled George up through the lip like a cork out of a bottle. But he was in quite a bad way. He'd broken the shoulder blade, and he was quite gashed around the cheek.
Well, that was whilst you were down there yourself?
This was before we arrived down in at Adelaide Island. So my trip down was the first time that George had seen anybody since this accident, and I flew him straight back up to Adelaide Island.
To see a doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
But he was jolly lucky. In fact, he and the other chum, David Binion, who both fell down crevasses, were both extremely lucky. Mm. In fact, one of the chaps who sailed down in the Nabisco with me to... he left us at Port Stanley, and he joined the Shackleton, and they went to Halley Bay. And we heard during the winter that this lad had gone out sledging with his dog team. And it was at the beginning of the summer, and he got out sledging, and the piece of ice that he was sledging on broke off, and he disappeared out to sea, never seen again. Dreadful.
So you were aware all the time you were down there that people sometimes didn't come back?
Oh yeah.
But you never, that never really worried you? Was it?
I don't think you tend to dwell on these sort of things.
No. You're a slightly invincible aspect of that age, are you?
Oh, I think so, yeah. But, you know, it was great. I learned a heck of a lot down there. We had a little Irish joiner who was involved in, with this other chap I was telling you about, Dick Stocks, building the huts. And this chap was amazed to discover that I knew how to use a set square. And he said, "What? You can do that, you know?" But I was, you know, quite proud. They had a porch at the entrance to this hut, and I double-glazed it. All my own work, you know, so marvellous.
All right, David.
Yep.
You happy? Thank you very much indeed.